Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush's current National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, is one step closer to becoming the nation's top diplomat. Late this morning, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee voted 16-2 to confirm her appointment as Secretary of State, the two nays being the senators who question Rice most intensely, John Kerry of Massachusetts and Barbara Boxer of California. And just as that vote was taking place, outgoing Secretary of State Colin Powell said goodbye to the people he called his family at the State Department.
And even though I step down as your secretary, I will never leave you. I will always be part of this wonderful family. Thank you all, and God bless you.
Joining us on the line now is Carol Giacomo, a diplomatic correspondent for Reuters. And Carol, a warm and very emotional goodbye at state for Colin Powell.
Yes, indeed. And this is quite unusual. Not since George Shultz left the State Department at the beginning of Bush's father's administration in 1989 has a Secretary of State received this kind of a farewell from his State Department colleagues. There were hundreds of people crammed into the C Street lobby, which is the main lobby of the State Department, to wish him well, and some of them shed some tears.
A demonstration of support for a man who hasn't received, some would say, a lot of support from the administration he worked for recently. Powell recently commented, for instance, on the need for an exit strategy from Iraq. President Bush immediately seemed to undermine him. Your sense of that, adding to the sense that he's being shoved on his way out?
Well, I think that's part and parcel of Colin Powell's unfortunate legacy with this administration, that he often espoused views that were not either backed up or in tune with where the president was. You'd also notice that in Connie Rice's confirmation hearings over the last 2 days, she also did not subscribe to Powell's view. In fact, when senators tried to pin her down on when the U.S. or what kind of an exit strategy the U.S. might have when the troops may be drawn down or may be pulled out entirely, she didn't want to pin herself down and said it depends on how the situation evolves. But, Powell was very much loved by his State Department troops, as he called them, and that's because he helped to do a lot of things for them.
Back diplomacy. Well, I want to talk more about Rice in a moment, but let's listen to another portion of Powell's very emotional farewell today. And I'm wondering if you think you hear a barb in here. Let's listen.
You are the carriers of America's values. You are the ones that go out not to lecture, not to impose, but to let our works go before us to show what democracy can bring to people in the way of a better life.
Carol Giacomo, was Powell firing back at the neocons at the Pentagon?
I think he was. I think it was a speech in which he tried to defend himself, defend the program that he espoused at the State Department, and to sort of set the record straight as he left the State Department. There have been a lot of sort of valedictory pieces written in the media about him in the last couple of weeks, all of which talked about how he lost so many battles at the State Department, how people feel that he's being pushed out, and how he sort of leaves, still an admired man, but with a diminished legacy.
Well, in fact, you were speaking of Condoleezza Rice. Powell referred to her as a dear friend, said she would bring gifted leadership to the State Department. But as you said, he was the outrider. She was always with the program, if you will, as National Security Advisor. How is the department anticipating her arrival?
Well, people are, of two minds, I think. On the one hand, I don't believe they think anybody is going to be their defender as Colin Powell was. He is a true military man, and the State Department personnel were his troops, and he did what he could and what he felt he needed to do for his troops. Condoleezza Rice, however, comes in with more political clout than Powell did. She has this relationship with the president, which is a very special relationship. She's a confidant of the president. She's his top foreign policy advisor. And in that sense, she may give the State Department more stature and certainly more clout within the interagency process than Powell was able to give.
And as we said today, late this morning, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee voted 16-2 to confirm her appointment. She is expected to receive the backing of the full Senate on Thursday. And just the few seconds we have, it'll be quite a day for President Bush, an inauguration and the, you know, his cabinet getting in order.
Indeed. And people will be looking to Bush's inaugural speech to sort of go a little bit farther than Condoleezza Rice did in her confirmation hearings this week in terms of setting out the U.S. policy, foreign policy agenda, as well as the domestic policy agenda for a second term.
Carol Giacomo is diplomatic correspondent for Reuters, speaking to us from Washington, D.C., where she's been following all of this. Carol, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, they are battening down the hatches in Washington, D.C., where it's snowing, in preparation for tomorrow's inauguration of President Bush. Giant steel fences are draping the streets around the Capitol, and more than 100 square blocks have been shut down. Utility crews are even welding shut manholes, all in an effort to make sure this inaugural event is the most secure in history. The stepped-up security is a reminder of how much the world has changed since President Bush first took office. But how has the office of the presidency changed George W. Bush and the First Lady? Joining us for a look at the first Bush presidency, we have Richard Wolff of Newsweek. Welcome, Richard.
Hi, good to be with you.
And we also have Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. Julie, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And I want to start with you because you covered the president when he was governor of Texas.
Yes.
What are the most striking differences that you see?
Well, there's several. The first thing you notice is that he looks exhausted. He's aged 10 years in the last four, and that's just a superficial thing. But he's improved as a speaker a little bit. I don't know if Richard would agree with that or not. But he's less likely to make malapropisms, as he did often when he was governor, as a candidate for president.
Richard, your thoughts on that?
I think he can deliver a speech much better than he used to. I think our view is kind of distorted. We got a lot of access to him in 2000. So there were more of these freewheeling conversations, and now it's much more scripted. And when you're only talking for 3 or 5 minutes a day publicly, I think it's kind of easier to avoid the Bushisms, as we used to call them.
And the technology has gotten better, too. He uses teleprompters, and his speech is often projected onto the back of a room, so he can read it while he's standing at a podium, which he didn't often have.
Well, and his horizon has expanded. I mean, do you feel that, Julie? It was famously noted that when he first took office, he had hardly traveled outside of the United States.
And was proud of that, too.
Yes. But can you feel that in him?
He definitely has a better grasp of issues and world issues. You can see that. I mean, I don't know how he could avoid becoming more educated as president.
And Richard, as you note in an article for Newsweek, it may not be as much that President Bush has changed on different levels, but that we might have had misperceptions about him.
Yeah, I think he is obviously a man who provokes very intense feelings, both for people who like him and people who don't. And I get the sense that after 4 years, we are left with some very strong caricatures about him, like he's doesn't like to get into details, or he surrounds himself with yes men. I think the reality is somewhat different. In maybe some cases, the White House is a victim of its own love of secrecy and discretion. I mean, you know, you tend not to believe it when you hear it from people and it's who work for him. But if they keep things so close to themselves, then it's not surprising people get an image of Bush that they form from the 2-3 second soundbite they hear on the nightly news.
I was interested in the yes men part of it, because especially with some of the cabinet appointments, for instance, critics are saying that President Bush is just surrounding himself with people who agree with him. But you relate an anecdote that sort of belies that.
Right. Well, were a couple of things. First of all, he fired a number of people who wanted to be yes men, and they were painful departures where people were in tears. Members of his cabinet, like Tommy Thompson, and even the president, I'm told. So, you know, the idea that he just wants people who'll do what he wants isn't kind of true in his cabinet. It's also not true with the people around him. And there was one story I particularly like from the campaign trail where Matt Dowd, his strategist, told him that, frankly, his performance in the first TV debate wasn't very good. Bush said, "Well, what do you mean?" And Dowd said, "Well, you got your ass kicked." And Bush takes Matt Dowd around Air Force One saying, you know, he said what he said, and can you believe it? And then he goes around to his other aides and says, "And you all said I won." And I think his language was even more colorful than that. But the point is that he may actually, this is a problem for all presidents. He obviously gets snippy when people are critical, but he actually encourages that too. And the idea that he only wants people who will tell him what he wants to hear may be some way from the truth.
I agree. I think the most important thing for him is loyalty, not so much yes men, but people who think like him and share his goals and visions more than people who just parrot back to him what he wants to hear.
What else did you see become a character, if you will, or a perception of President Bush that you did not see in Texas?
Well, that he is just across the board dumb. You know, he's a very perceptive, very wily politician. He understands people. He can size people up in a split second. And that is a very acute form of intelligence that people don't give him credit for. They think he's just this sort of, you know, slap-happy frat boy behind the scenes. I mean, another thing is he's gotten a lot more serious since 9/11. You still see the flashes of wit. But the idea that he's dumb is not accurate.
Well, Richard, President Bush is also perceived as a president who likes to tackle big issues. Could that ambition also be his undoing?
The president and his senior aides talk about his ambition. I think that can backfire on you. If your ambition is so huge that you can only, you're doing big things just because they're big, then you can get into a lot of trouble. And I think that's in part laid behind some of the problems in Iraq. Now he's talking about the whole region. It's as if when things are bad, the president wants to get even more ambitious. And you can be the victim of your own ambition here in doing too many things and not being aware of the pitfalls of that ambition. I think there are things there that may be the seeds of his own problem.
Julie, I want to ask you, there are a lot of Bush detractors who have been critical of his use of his own faith over the last 4 years. Has the president been getting more religion recently, or is this something you saw in Texas?
Well, he definitely lately, especially just since the election, this past election, he's been going to church a lot more. He talks about faith intermittently. On Friday, the day after his inauguration, the first thing he's going to do is go to a big prayer breakfast. So it sort of comes and goes, but I think that he understands who helped get him elected, and he is, you know, appeasing them a little bit. But he is very religious.
And you say he understands who helped get him elected.
Mm-hmm.
Some would say that would be the woman standing at his side.
Yes, indeed.
Richard, we're going to talk a little bit more about Laura Bush and how she might have changed or not changed over the last 4 years. But your sense of her role in his presidency?
Well, she's certainly not a yes woman. She talks pretty straight to him. We've seen that most recently. You know, he's finally admitting to having made some mistakes, and one of those is about language. Saying he wanted Osama bin Laden dead or alive, that was not something Laura liked, and she communicated that in a forthright fashion to him. So, you know, she corrects his behavior, corrects his public pronunciations, and I'm told as well that she's a very important factor, and so are his daughters, in his position on abortion. I was told that if he ever had a vote in his family, he would lose on abortion 3-1.
Well, in fact, as you write, Richard, that may be why we're not going to hear as much about social issues such as abortion or gay marriage in the new term. But let's pause here for now. We're talking to Richard Wolff of Newsweek and Julie Mason of the Houston Chronicle about the Bush presidency. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation, and we'll look at how the glare of the public eye has transformed the First Lady and the Bush twins. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been talking about the Bush presidency and how the last 4 years have left their mark on George W. Bush, the nation, and his family. Joining us to talk about the evolution of the Bush presidency are Richard Wolff, political correspondent for Newsweek. Welcome back, Richard.
Good to be with you.
And Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. Hi, Julie.
Howdy.
And we left on a note where, Richard, you said that you heard that if President Bush took a vote within his family on Roe v. Wade and abortion, he'd lose. Some are speculating that that's why we may not be hearing that much about social issues in the new Bush presidency, that his family has not got as strong a stand on some of these issues as let's say, the right wing of the party might want.
Right, or I think as he would like. I've been told before that he's the most conservative member of his family, just in terms of his siblings, but When it comes to these social things, you know, one thing that struck me in 2000 was in the hours of conversation we'd have on his plane, really the social issues never really came up. Certainly that's something his friends and his close aides say as well. He'll talk about foreign policy now. He may have talked before about economic policy, about taxes, but these kinds of hot-button social issues that were so prominent in the election are not something that really motivate him at a personal level. Now, that's not to say he doesn't engage in them politically. He knows who his base is, as Julie said. He's got to deal with that and look after them. But I wouldn't expect really aggressive action. Of course, where the rubber hits the road is in judicial appointments. So that's a sort of different area. But in terms of what motivates him and inspires him, if he really wanted to take down abortion rights, this would be the moment, and we're not seeing that.
Well, and Julie, Laura Bush made it clear just after President Bush took office in 2001 that she didn't think the Supreme Court's Roe versus Wade decision should be undone.
Right, but you notice that's as far as she'd go. And she's often asked, where are the policy areas where you disagree with your husband? And she says, well, I'm not going to tell you. So her positions, the ambiguity of her positions also give him a certain amount of cover.
Yeah.
He can have it both ways. And you saw the same thing in the first, in Bush 41. Barbara Bush was widely suspected to have been pro-choice. She never said it, but it gave him a lot of cover. It softened his hardline position, and they're doing the same thing with Laura.
And she appears to be doing the same thing with gay marriage, indicating that she may disagree with her husband's opposition to gay marriage.
Yeah, but again, it's more of a hint. She doesn't stake out a position. I'm not sure it would be appropriate for her to do so. I mean, that's an arguable point, but she doesn't stake out a position. She just drops little hints and sort of with body language and language. And again, it gives him a little bit of cover.
And by the way, Richard, I want to talk more about Laura Bush, but how is this going to impact President Bush politically in the second term when the conservative base was so instrumental in getting him into office?
Well, I actually think he's going to face more intense opposition from the conservatives within his own party and within his own political base than he does from the Democrats. And we're already seeing this on Social Security, for instance, where you've got at least 15, 20 House Republicans being very open about opposing his what we've seen so far of his plans for partial privatization of Social Security. So there's a real problem there. And if he doesn't move on some of these social issues quickly, then he's also going to face a backlash there, too. I think he's going to try and inhabit this sort of ambiguous gray area, and that can be pretty uncomfortable for him.
Boy, he's facing critics of his social policy at home and in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
But, Julie, you've covered the Bushes since they were in the Texas State House, as we said. What changes have you seen in Laura Bush since 2000?
She's changed a lot. She back in Texas, she was a lot more natural. She had a lot of warmth. She's lost, I would say, every trace of her public warmth. I mean, her public face is obviously very different from her private side. But she's lost her warmth. She's very hard-edged now, very different from when she was back in Texas.
Really? Why do you think that is?
Well, I think just the reality of the scrutiny of being who she is, the very prominent role she was required to take in this last campaign. You know, she would never relished campaigning. She doesn't love it. They really had her do it. She was a trooper. One of the things that's really obvious about her now is to sublimate her stress, she works out all the time. So she's very buff. She's very strong, and her physical presence is a lot tighter and more reserved, more cautious.
You know, I'm thinking too, one of the things she might be reacting to, and Richard, jump in on this, is the scrutiny that her daughters were under in the last 4 years.
I think that has been very awkward for them. It was certainly, they were very very private, very reluctant in 2000 to get involved, to have the daughters out there. Of course, the daughters have been putting themselves out there. Now they're adults and very much part of the social scene in Washington. You know, they get their own publicity, and most of that isn't favorable.
And there were, of course, the charges of underage drinking.
That's right. They do like to, go out every once in a while. So that's a problem for the whole family in terms of where they think they are. Maybe it's not a problem for the daughter so much as it is for the mother, for Laura.
But, Julie, you point out that unlike her mother-in-law, Laura Bush might have these feelings about the press, for instance, but she doesn't act on them.
No, she doesn't. She's very cautious with the press. She's very guarded, always has her guard up. Yet at the same time, she tries to convey sort of a candor and warmth. But sometimes it comes off as very artificial.
What do you think is going to happen in the year to come? And just a couple minutes we have left. How do you, each of you, see the second Bush presidency shaping up on all these arenas we've been talking about? Richard?
Well, let me say, on a policy level, I think we're only going to have about a year of concentration on domestic policy before it all becomes foreign, foreign policy dominated. Just the dynamics of the presidential cycle is going to be at play here. And secondly, you know, this is a president who says, I don't think about my legacy, that's all for the history books. But actually, they are thinking about their legacy, they are thinking about the family dynasty, and that's going to become increasingly apparent in the last couple of years. More reflective, I think. Obviously, they're going to be engaged in the presidential library as well, but you may see more of a human touch in those out years.
Well, Julia, I'm just thinking from what Richard said, you know, that the domestic policy issues may be swamped by foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. I would add that he has 2 years to get everything done that he wants to get done, and then he's in his lame duck years, and you know, the chances for passing anything meaningful or getting anything meaningful done sort of diminish.
Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Houston Chronicle, Richard Wolff, political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Thank you both for a look ahead and a look back at the Bush presidency.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, George W. Bush makes his second inaugural address tomorrow at noon Eastern Time. We'll have reports from Washington and review some of the president's agenda for the next 4 years. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Indonesia's foreign minister says both sides in that country's decades-long conflict are hoping to sit down to formal peace talks at the end of the month. One of the few silver linings in the tsunami disaster has been the prospect that a power greater than the separatist rebels and the government forces may force the two sides to forge a peace deal, and rebels and government troops have already agreed to a ceasefire to allow aid into the Aceh region. Well, Knight Ridder reporter Ken Moritsugu is also in Aceh and recently had a rare meeting with some of the rebels. He joins us on the line from the provincial capital, Banda Aceh. And Ken, you went to a mountain village to interview people who'd fled the coastal area, but how did you come across the rebels?
We weren't really expecting to meet the rebels, and about 50 yards from the village, all of a sudden you noticed a couple young men standing on the side dressed in T-shirts and jeans with their machine guns, either their M16s or their AK-47s over their shoulders.
What did they say to you?
They said absolutely nothing. The person who was our local guide, he said, don't worry, just be calm and just walk right in and don't worry about it. And so we did, and we went, and he showed us where the refugees were. And the men with the guns just sort of watched in the background, just sort of kept an eye on us while we were doing our interviews.
We understand that you ultimately spoke to one of the rebel commanders in the village. What is your sense of what kind of danger the rebels pose, either to the aid workers or to the Indonesian military?
Well, if the Indonesian military were to show up in that area, I would be very surprised if there weren't some kind of confrontation, some kind of shooting. I mean, they're still mortal enemies. As far as aid workers, I mean, it's a little bit of a toss-up. I mean, most of the assistance is being delivered in the larger towns where there are refugee camps. I think for aid workers going to those kinds of areas, there's not really any danger posed by the rebels. If aid workers were to to venture out into the more mountainous areas, the commander told me that there's absolutely no intent to harm any Asian workers who would welcome them here. But again, that's based on talking to one commander, and it is a large group, and I'm not sure that everybody is on the same page on that.
Ken Moritsugu is a reporter for Knight Ridder Newspapers. He spoke to us from Banda Aceh on a tough cell phone line, but Ken, thanks.
Okay, thanks.
Well, we turn now to Zachary Abuza. He's a professor of international relations at Simmons College. And Professor Abuza, or Zach, you've said I can call you Zach. We just heard from a reporter, Ken Moritsugu, that a rebel, a member of the Aceh movement, or GAM, has told him that the Indonesian military is a mortal enemy. Why? Remind us briefly, what's this conflict about?
GAM has been fighting for an independent homeland since 1976, and the conflict is really over natural resources. Aceh is very wealthy in terms of natural gas and oil, and the proceeds have never gone back to the Achenese people.
Right. We understand that the GAM movement actually has a government in exile in Sweden, and there have been negotiations. One as recently as 2002, where there was agreement for a truce and a peace process. What happened?
The Indonesian government broke the peace agreement and started an all-out offensive against them beginning in 2003.
Yeah, we understand then-President Sukarno Putri bowed to pressure from the military. Is the Indonesian military pretty independent from the government?
Very independent, and that's really one of the top priorities of the current president, Yudhoyono, to get them more under civilian control.
But in the meantime, we have the Indonesian military and GAM launching accusations at each other. What's your sense of what the Indonesian military is saying about the rebels? In other words, telling reporters and aid workers they can't go in the region because of danger.
I think they're overinflating the risk to journalists and reporters. GAM has never really had a beef against Westerners, and certainly their families have been most impacted by the tsunami. And I just can't imagine that they would threaten relief workers.
Well, why would the Indonesian military issue these warnings then?
The Indonesian military had shut down Aceh from international observers, aid workers, journalists for 18 months because of their military campaign there and their egregious human rights record. And I think they're very concerned that Westerners are getting in and are able to speak to GAM and for GAM to be able to get in contact with foreign journalists and to state their case.
Given the egregious human rights record of the Indonesian military, which in fact the U.S. has made statements about, what is the U.S. position on the Indonesian military?
Well, the United States government right now is using the tsunami crisis to restore bilateral military relations. Those were severed in 1999 because of the Indonesian military's support of militias and their own role in egregious human rights violations in East Timor secessionist movement. The U.S. government, and in particular the Defense Department, has really wanted to restore ties to Indonesia, but Congress has restricted this. The Leahy Amendment limits what bilateral military exchanges, arms sales, and IMET training for Indonesian military officials. There are a lot of people in the administration who feel that as Indonesia is the largest Muslim country in the world, a key partner in the war on terror, this cutting off bilateral military ties is counterproductive.
Right.
And so Undersecretary of Defense Wolfowitz went to Jakarta last week really pushing for the restoration of ties.
And by the way, IMET
is the International Military Education Training Program.
And what is your sense? Indonesia's foreign minister said that there have been some informal talks between the Indonesian government and GAM members, and that there may be another formal peace talk, maybe even this month. What is your sense of whether or not that's going to happen? Because the government is not, as we've said, the military.
President Yudhoyono has made it a priority to resolve this conflict, and he's come
come out and said, you know, a former general himself has said, we cannot win this by military means. There has to be a political solution. So even before the tsunami took place, you know, the government was moving in that direction. I think with the tsunami disaster, there is an opportunity for both sides to come out and negotiate something based on long-term economic rehabilitation and using the region's vast mineral and oil and natural gas resources to reconstruct the region.
Zachary Abuza is a professor of international relations at Simmons College, author of Militant Islam in Southeast Asia. Professor Abuza, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Here and Now. The controversy over whether or not Boston University should be allowed to build a new $128 million biodefense lab in a densely populated neighborhood became more heated today. City and school officials acknowledged that three workers in an existing lab were infected with a potentially deadly tularemia or rabbit fever bacterium. The Boston Globe reports that Boston University did report the cases to Boston health officials, but the school and the mayor decided there was no need to tell residents, and the city's zoning commission gave final approval to BU's new high-tech bio lab last week. Stephen Smith is health reporter for the Boston Globe. He wrote today's story, and Stephen, first of all, why did they feel there was no need for residents to know?
Robin, tularemia is a bacterium that is transmitted typically by insects or by animals, notably rabbits, thus the name rabbit fever. It's not ever been identified as being transmitted person to person, so from the perspective of the university as well as public health authorities, it did not constitute a threat to broader public health because it can't be transmitted person to person.
But this came at a time, this outbreak came at a time when Boston University was, as we said, in a bid for a new biotech lab.
Certainly, I came at an awkward time for the university. In September 2003, it was one of two universities that won a high-stakes competition to build two new biosafety level four labs in the nation. These are labs in which the deadliest germs and bacteria known to mankind can be researched, pathogens such as plague, anthrax, Ebola.
And there have been opponents to that lab being built. What are they saying today after today's news?
Well, the opponents feel that the accident in another lab at Boston University, a lab known as a biosafety level two lab, indicates the risks of doing research on pathogens, and particularly doing that research, they say, in a densely populated neighborhood such as the one in which Boston University's medical campus is located.
Oh, and what is BU saying in response to that?
BU's response is that the events in the Level 2 lab are not relevant to the ongoing debate swirling around the Level 4 lab, because they say the level of security in a level four lab would assure that this type of accident could never occur. In a level four lab, researchers wear those moon suits, and all research is done in these enclosed boxes with air filters that cleanse any of the air in the level four lab of any sort of dangerous agent.
And we should say that many well-known infectious disease specialists from around the country are also agreeing with Boston University that there was no danger of a further outbreak after the rabbit fever, if you will, outbreaks that you've reported. How did they exhibit it? How do you know you have this?
The symptoms are what would appear for all the world to be flu-like symptoms, fever, cough, headache. In some cases, it can progress to pneumonia. And because these researchers believe that they were working with a strain that is widely regarded as posing little threat, they believed when they became ill that there was no link with their research. It was only months later when DNA analyses were performed that it became evident that, unknown to these scientists, the strains that they were working with, the material that they were working with, contained both the harmless type of tularemia and the more highly infectious form that occurs in nature.
And Boston University also says that these workers were not using the safety outline that they should have been. And Boston University said it's going to tighten oversight of research. But meanwhile, the Boston City Zoning Commission gave final approval to the lab just last week. That has more to do with the land than anything else. What happens next?
Well, right now there is still final federal approval of the project needed, and that's widely considered a foregone conclusion since it was the feds back in September 2003 who said, all right, Boston University, you've won this competition. You can build this laboratory that is expected over the next 20 years to generate upwards of $1.6 billion in construction and research grants.
But do you think it's still a fait accompli after your report today?
I would not dare to prognosticate such a thing. I think the situation remains fluid.
Stephen Smith, health reporter for the Boston Globe. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And this note, Here and Now is a production of WBUR, whose license is held by Boston University. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. He says, call him a career door kicker. Staff Sergeant Terry Blogg is an Army Ranger, one of the most elite combat soldiers in the U.S. military. But he's also a kicker of a different sort, a professional ballet dancer with the Columbia City Ballet in South Carolina. In fact, 34-year-old Staff Sergeant Blogg is the company's first full-time active-duty military dancer. But he's having to hang up his ballet slippers for a while because, along with many other soldiers in the Army's 3rd Infantry Division, Staff Sergeant Terry Blogg is being deployed to Iraq. He'll be departing in the next day or so. But first, he joins us on the line from Savannah, Georgia. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Well, I know you know that people are fascinated about your dual careers, which seem contradictory, you know, ballet and being a soldier.
Yeah, they actually are. It's two pretty extreme states of mind doing them. You know, because I started dancing when I was 10, but I started martial arts when I was 5, both for the same reason. My mom made me. And I hated dance, though, at first. I was a horrible student. I don't know how my early teachers ever put up with me. I was always ditching class and, you know, tricking, you know, the girls in the class into going across the street to eat ice cream, and that's
and you were allowed to stay, and eventually dancing took.
You know, it wasn't until after I got in the military and went to college using my GI Bill that I really gained an appreciation for it, and particularly ballet of all things, which is I think what attracted me to it the most, though, was the extreme discipline and movement. There is a right, there is a wrong. And it's so hard to get it right. Nothing is ever, it's never good enough. You can never have enough turnout. You can never do enough turns. The leap's never high enough.
Well, oddly enough, you have also said that that's what ballet has in common with being a soldier, that extreme discipline. Explain that.
Well, there's, of course, personal discipline, but the other thing that I find in common with the dancers and with soldiers is their heart and will to win. And like in the military, so many of my friends, you know, and myself included, push through injury, a lot of times very extreme injury, to get the job done, just like dancers do. I'm amazed that some of the dancers that I've worked with can do the things they do with the injuries that they've got. And, you know, it's just they want it so bad that they're willing to sacrifice just about everything in order to get the job done.
Right.
And in the military, it's missions. For the dance world, it's putting on a performance, and, you know, they may collapse in the wings at the end of the show, but they gave a good show, and that's really what counts.
Oh, in fact, we know you broke your ankle once, right, on stage.
Yeah, I got in big trouble for that one, too.
What do you mean you got in trouble?
I was in the Nutcracker production, and part of the choreography called for a couple of tumbling passes, because since I grew up also doing gymnastics, I've always been typecast as the Russian everywhere I've gone. And so, anyway, I missed my landing and broke my ankle. And unfortunately, I was supposed to participate in an endurance event the following day.
You mean for the Army?
Yeah. There were, I think there were 4 of us out of my group that that went down to injury that weekend. 2 guys playing football, One of my soldiers broke both of his elbows. And then there was me. And when he got to me, he's like, "And Sergeant Blog," he's like, "what am I supposed to do with you? Am I to assume that ballet dancing is to be considered a hazardous activity and I need to include it on the safety briefing? What do you have to say for yourself?" And, you know, I couldn't really say anything. I'm just like, "No excuse for a sergeant." And he's like, "Get out of here." You know, so I limped away on my crutches, but it wasn't my best moment.
Well, what do your fellow soldiers think about you being a dancer?
It was hard at first, and I took a lot of ridicule. It didn't become cool until we went to a show. And so I dragged my buddies along. And dancers are sort of a touchy-feely group to begin with. Like a hug and a kiss to a dancer is like normal people shaking hands. And so my meathead friends saw me getting basically attacked by a bunch of beautiful women. And
this is the soldiers who saw you with your dancer friends.
Exactly. So then word got back. "Holy cow, you should see the gig Blog has. No wonder he's never here after work." You know.
This ballet dancing thing is looking me better and better.
Exactly. And I even cashed in like 2 years worth of favors and got some of them up on stage to be extras during one of the performances. So,
in fact, one of the dancers at the Columbia City Ballet is your girlfriend.
Mm.
You're going to have to say goodbye to her.
Yeah, that was pretty much my jello moment, because I won't see her again until I come back.
Yeah. Well, because what you do is very dangerous. I mean, you're a soldier.
Yeah.
You go into combat zones. I don't know how much you want to tell us about what you do, but it's a dangerous mission.
Yes, it is. I have to be pretty vague about a lot of things, but our missions could include just about anything, from, you know, raids, ambushes. It could be anything.
Yeah.
So we just have to keep training and keep, you know, rehearsals. So we just have to keep doing it.
Right. As all soldiers do, you have to shoot. And, you know, sure. As a soldier, you may kill another human. Maybe you have killed another human. The arts is all about celebrating humanity and the human body, you know, and dance is all about celebrating the human body.
This is true. People ask me, how can I do both? How can I live in both worlds? And the answer is, it's simple. As a dancer, what do you do between Act 1 and Act 2? You change your costume. And if you're playing a different role, then that's the role you play. Sometimes, though, it gets confusing. Like, you know, I can be on a long airplane flight or something, getting ready to jump, and I'm thinking to myself, "Oh, wow, the company's performing tonight. Oh, I wish I was there." Or I could be in class and glance out the window and, you know, just do a quick range estimation or observe the wind and, you know, just seeing how that would affect my shot. So I'm constantly living in both worlds. And the part about, you know, taking lives, that's just the price of doing business. It's not nice, but somebody's got to do it. And, you know, I'm very well trained, and this is what the country expects me to do. And that's why I'm here.
Well, and that's a very serious take on what you do. But there are, before we let you go, there are lighter moments when your two interests combine. I'm thinking, well, for instance, is it true you've stacked ammo boxes to do bar exercises?
Yeah, well, and I bring my TheraBand and you know, my stretching rope and everything. Sometimes that gets a little crazy too, because a lot of my stretches are not really according to the Army manual, and I've taken criticism for that before. But what I point out is I'm the most flexible person I've ever met in uniform. So when you show me that you can stretch better than me, then I'll listen. And that usually shuts people up.
Terry Blog is a professional soldier, a U.S. Army Ranger with the 3rd Infantry Division. He's also a professional ballet dancer with the Columbia City Ballet in South Carolina. This week he's being deployed to Iraq along with other units in the Army's 3rd Infantry Division. Terry, Sergeant, thanks so much for speaking with us, and best of luck to you.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.